At the end of June, as I do each year, I travel to the annual meeting of the Unitarian Universalist Association. The meeting is held in a different city every year, and this year was New Orleans. I have to tell you that I was trepidatious about this meeting. Unitarian Universalism has had a troubled spring. Some months ago, the director of Congregational Life, who's third on the org chart, hired a new regional lead for the southern region, the field staff director for that part of the country, kind of like a bishop, but without the fancy title or the fancy hat, or most of the power that a bishop has. The hire, a guy that I know, in fact, I know all of the characters in this story. We are a small tribe. The hire was a straight white guy from Arizona. He was qualified for the job, for sure, but all of the regional leaders, all five of them, are white ministers, as he was. And there was a qualified lay Latina woman who had also applied. And the word got out. People were unhappy, to say the least. It wasn't the one hire, right? It was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's a pattern going back years of words up here and actions down here. And then the president of the association issued a letter that was defensive and argumentative and accused his female critics of hysteria. I have found it is best to never, 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 ever use the word hysteria to describe a woman in any way. Really never, especially one making a well-considered point about justice. That's especially inappropriate. He resigned a few days later. After that, the number two guy on the org chart and the number three guy, the guys who approved the hire, that was the number two guy and the guy who made the hire, resigned too. The board appointed a team of interim presidents, and they were doing good work. We had an election in New Orleans, so there was only about 9 weeks that they needed a new president. But it was a mess. The executive director of the Ministers Association, which is a separate professional group, issued a letter defending his friend and seminary roommate, the president. It was a tone-deaf and hurtful letter. And then rather than say, I'm sorry, I was feeling loyal to my friend, I made a mistake, let's fix it, he resigned too. Jeez. In fact, that was the pattern. All of these folks could have said, we have learning to do, we screwed up, we can do better, I'm sorry, here's the plan, and kept their jobs. Nobody was actually asking for them to quit. The demand was for repair, for better work, but they quit instead. So I was trepidatious. I thought the meeting was going to be an emotional mess with recriminations and accusations and drama and all the things that I just can't stand. It's been a great year at our local church here in Rockford. We're doing good work, but in mid-June, I was tired. I'm better now, I've had some vacation. But I was ready to start that summer slowdown and rest, and I did not have the energy for the big cry and the drama, and it wasn't. The leader said, this happened, here's what we're doing next. The team of co-presidents was wise and loving, and everyone said, okay, let's do better. We didn't get sucked into the drama. We elected a new president. We looked forward. We went to workshops about race and power and also worship with good music. And we talked about our best fundraising ideas, a new curriculum for religious education. And we ate delicious food. It was New Orleans, after all. And we caught up with our friends about their lives. And we talked about what we're doing all over the country to offer sanctuary to immigrants, to work for reproductive justice, to work for healthcare access, and what we were going to do next. I got inspired. We talked about the new folks coming to our congregations since November, who come hungry for meaning and for action, and what we're doing. And we talked about what vacations we were going to take this summer so that we could be ready to rock and roll in the fall. And it was good. It was far better than I expected. And I thought, we can do this. It's a time of change, where our theology has a chance to overcome our culture. This is the time. We can do this. And I was proud of the leaders who'd stepped in to fill the vacuum, the co-presidents and the new acting director of the Ministers Association and the teams that put on worship and the boards and the commissions and the folks who said, we can do this. They were holding the space, doing good work. The men had learned, at least most of them, in the words of the poet Marge Piercy, to stop dancing solos on the ceiling. And the women, in the same poet's words, were saying, this is so. And almost everyone, men, women, trans folks, were focused on a common goal, that we might thrive, so that we might make a difference in the world. After the conference ended, I stayed for some vacation. It was New Orleans, so you should stay. The food was so good. And we went to see live music. Some of it was fabulous. I took this picture, it was good. And some of the music wasn't, actually. Sunday night was better. Tuesday night, walking back that night, we observed that there was an inverse relationship between the time the musicians spent doing solos and the quality of the band. The band, made up of folks who were playing together for what seemed like maybe the first time, they just rotated playing solos. First the trumpet, then the guitar, then the drummer, then the trombone. Each player was okay. Some of them were pretty good. And they were playing the same song, which they'd all learned somewhere else, but they didn't play together. But the band who played together, played together. The horns and the string kept the beat as one. The backup singer sang in harmony with the lead, and the people danced, and you forgot that there were individual members of the band. You just heard the music. It was really striking. And I said to Cindy as we were walking home, I said, that's my topic for July 30th. There's something off about me. I know that. Thinks about sermon topics on vacation, but you know, that's the way it goes. You know what I mean, right? We've all been in groups when we've been really playing in the band, when we've been working as one and making beauty and magic. And maybe it was a literal band or a choir. Maybe it was with coworkers when you were just firing together and making it happen. Maybe it was with your spouse or your partner, living life and moving through the days with sweetness and making love and traveling together and living. With friends hanging out and the conversation just sparkles. Whatever it was right. You know this feeling? That moment when you transcend yourself together in company with others, and the whole is really greater than the sum of the parts. And we've had the other thing too, right? When nobody is really listening to each other, we're talking past each other. Everyone's trying to show off rather than do it together. When individual agendas are more important than the mission, it doesn't just happen in the halls of Congress or in the State House, does it? When a conversation is stilted, or just doesn't happen at all, when people don't trust each other, don't say what they want or listen to each other, when we don't stretch to be great but rest on what we already know, when nobody has the courage or the skill to say, let's try something different. Casey stands before the plate. He looks great. He doffs his hat, the crowd cheers. He will rescue the team all on his own. He's the star. He waits for the perfect pitch. Not that one. Not that one. Oops. My first question, reading this poem again for the first time in years, if the star hitter is at bat, and there are runners at third and second, two outs and nobody at first, don't you walk him? Right? I mean, you walk him. And you try to get the force out on the next batter. This is not hard. This is basic baseball. So I have to think that the only reason the pitcher is going to throw to Casey is because he knows something. That Casey is all swagger. That he won't swing when it's not perfect, and that he can't lay off the heat when it comes. In short, the pitcher knows that Casey puts his own glory ahead of the interest of the team. And that's why the pitcher's team is going to win. And there'll be no joy in Mudville. Now, some will blame the umpire and refuse to believe that their dear leader could ever make a mistake. Does that sound familiar? But we know the truth. Poets speak the truth. He put himself ahead of the team and he blew it. If you want to lead other people, says the Tao Te Ching, you must put their interest ahead of your own. That'd be a nice change of pace, wouldn't it? You know, Thursday night, I thought, well, it was surprising because it doesn't happen very often. It used to, I think, that people would put the interest of the people ahead of their own. But there's more to this than about political leadership. The invitation of the Tao Te Ching to place herself in service to others, to the motion of the Tao, to lay aside ego for the common good, is matched in many other religions. In Islam's call to surrender, in Buddhism's reminder of the truth of no self. It's a call in religious naturalism to remember that we are part of the web of life and not its weaver or its owner. We play in the band together. When we place the mission, in that case, making music above our own desires for a moment of fame. Our leaders put Unitarian Universalism on a better path when they asked, how can we serve the mission? Instead of, how can I be comfortable? When we thrive, it is because we place ourselves in service to a cause larger than our own life. This is how we transcend our finitude and how we learn to soar and how we deal with conflicts and how we make the world better and how we build lives worth living. By placing ourselves in service to something more than ourselves. The truth is that we all seek to transcend ourselves. We seek a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. We seek to participate in something that matters. But this desire for participation, for teamwork, for meaning, is, as the Unitarian Universalist ethicist Sharon Welch has written, fundamentally amoral. We can find a sense of purpose in being part of a team that does evil, just as much as a team that does good. Many do. Many, many do. They confuse the good feeling that comes from being part of a team with the good feeling that comes from doing good. When police officers cheer when a president says, let's beat up our suspects, they've confused the good feeling of being part of a team with the good feeling of doing good. So our work for justice can't just be about being on a team with people like us, who reinforce our sense of superiority or cheer when we are at bat, who think the umpire is always wrong. We need more than that. We need to reach out to folks not like us, who have different ideas, and to learn from and participate with and grow from being with others. A great musician is always listening to new and different things. They listen more than they play. A great human being is always listening to new human beings, learning more, reaching, listening, discovering. This is risky, to reach out and join with others. Sometimes it feels safer to say, we can't play, we can't, the big fish will eat us all. But sometimes someone will reach out to us and say, I need you on my team. We can do more together. And your job is to say yes. Not to say yes to anything, let me say that, but to say yes to something that makes the world better. something that we can do with others to make more beauty and more justice and more wonder. I couldn't hit a fastball either, and nobody wants me to be holding a trombone or playing the piano. Trust me, those are not my skill sets. I get asked to be part of teams every day, to play in the metaphorical band of 1,000 issues. Sometimes I say yes, but mostly I say no. Give them another name. Because I want the teams I'm already on to play well together. Those are both professional teams and personal teams, if you will. So I'm not saying join everything. You'll be stretched too thin. But find where you are called, where your gifts matter, where you can play with the band, where your contribution will really matter. Drop the drama and the solo virtuoso display, the preening for approval and the displays of righteousness. Do what needs to be done in a way that feels meaningful, that is joy. Frederick Buechner wrote that calling is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. And that's what I want to invite you to transcend yourselves, your finitude, the limitations of what one person can do by themselves, by serving the world's hunger with others, by learning, trusting, moving together, so that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, so that you forget, even if just for a moment, that there are individual musicians or separate fish, but see one band, one fish, one humanity, one family, one congregation, singing together, living together, growing together. This is joy. This is purpose. This is harmony, not just with each other, but with the spirit of life, which flows through all things. This is what, in the end, makes the world sweeter and our own lives worthy of the gift we are each given. This body, this spirit, this time, placed in service for the sake of justice, for joy, for love. May you find your place in the music, your seat at the table, your spot in the lineup, and may you find yourself forgetting yourself as you make together a life that matters. May it be so, and may you be glad. Let's sing together. 318 in your gray hymnal. We would be